I'm Rob Hirschfeld, CEO and co-founder of Rakuten and your host for the Cloud 2030 podcast. In this episode, we talk about Vision One. It's this synthesis between humanoid robots and LLM AI. Fascinating potential. We really got excited about this idea that robots could be navigating spatial environments, learning from their environment, or at least interpreting their environment in very human ways and interacting with humans from simple instructions. This started from a small video that's in the show notes, something that you might want to watch all the way through even before you hear us talk about it. If you don't want to watch the video, that's fine. You'll still get a lot from the conversation because we really analyze not just what's going on in the video, but why we think it's significant and how it's going to have implications in how people interact with artificial intelligence in the near term. So a fascinating discussion that I know you will enjoy.
I put the link in the chat. Okay. If you have not seen this video of Figure One launched by OpenAI together with Figure One AI, watch it now, because it is, in my view, the bellwether for the next 2 years of technology, and the impact on CIOs is going to be enormous for one reason. They have to get out of their headspace and start thinking in terms of synergies, combinations, and the use of technology for productivity. So I will leave you with these two words before you take a look at it, and I hope that you will. Think about a palletizing robot and an autonomous truck. So why isn't the palletizing robot or the pick-pack robot on the back of the last piece of equipment loaded into the semi-trailer that's autonomously driven? That's a combination. That's a combination that says I can pack it myself, the self, and I can unload it wherever it needs to be. That means I can then take the drivers of the trucks and the warehouse general labor and upskill them to be either running warehouses, laying out warehouses, or management systems that do not necessarily require education in the traditional sense of curricula of universities, but leverage their innate and experiential levels of knowledge for good. This was a game changer. Huge.
So, in my so I've seen a little bit of this, figure pieces, and literally it just started popping up on my feed. So Figure is, just so everybody's aware, it's a humanoid form robot, and they actually look like they've done a really good job mimicking human form. So it's, it basically has the same proportions, the same dexterity as a human worker. It can lift 40 pounds, which is, a pretty good starting point for operational, but it has a very fine motor dexterity on the hands and the grip.
And it has the capacity to intake human speech, follow up commands. It learns on the fly. It doesn't just use ChatGPT, but it uses various forms of AI. Figure.ai is the robotic maker. Right. They're in partnership with OpenAI. Combined, they came up with this thing called Figure One. This is one of the most advanced humanoid cobots that there is. And why it's such a game changer is this exemplifies everything that was the precepts of Industry 4, Smart Manufacturing, and Industry 5 over the last 20 years rolled into one. And why it's such a game changer for CIOs is you need to start thinking in combinations, not of tools, not of solving a single problem, but using technologies, how they're applied, being much more important to what those technologies actually are. And yes, in the video, you'll see there's a bit of a communications lag. And yes, there's some unanswered questions. Like when you see it, you'll see that there's plates. Well, how does the figure one know that the plates are clean versus dirty? But the prompt at the beginning of the video basically says, in the current scene. Therefore, it's making assumptions that you have criteria behind the in the current scene. But this was, to me, the thing that I have been waiting for to start exemplifying where my brain goes when I think about the fourth industrial revolution, advanced technologies, how things work together to solve a problem. Ergo, autonomous vehicles and cobots change the world. That's my little
and moment. The thing that's really surprising here is you're talking about learned decks. This is they're talking about learned operations. So it's not pre-programmed pick up the plate. What you're saying is it's not pre-programmed pick up the plates or things like that. It's using learned behavior to identify. You know, the AI is able to say, okay, I can identify what a plate is based on my visual field, and then it can figure out the motion by itself rather than being programmed motion. Okay.
Yeah, and you'll notice also that even though the Apple it doesn't reach across in front, you know, like left to right on an angle, it passes the Apple from the left hand to the right hand to the individual. And I'm not sure if that's a safety issue that it's been trained, you know, don't go within a certain distance to the human, or if it's just something that has not been thought of yet.
Because it does something, actually take a look at it again, because it does something even better. It transfers the Apple from one hand to the other. And then when the human holds his hand out,
it drops
the robot. The robot does not put it in his hand. It puts it about four to six inches above his hand and then releases the apple, and it drops into his hand.
You are correct. 100% correct. I've watched it probably 50 times. And each time I have another question that comes to my mind. Like he says, can I have something to eat? And the robot doesn't say, what would you like? Or make a move to go in another direction as a human would. It takes in exactly what's in its LIDAR and it's in its context and then says to him, because the only thing I had available was an apple. Like, how did it not know the plates were clean or dirty, but it put them in the dish drainer? All of these little things are clearly in part machine learning and learning on the fly. This is what's in my scene. This is all I need to know. I can't turn and go to a refrigerator to give you something else to eat. And with the garbage as well, right? It picks it up and it puts it somewhere because it knows it's been told in speech, it's garbage. So it doesn't leave it on the counter. It immediately empties it away.
There's another moment in here where it like gently bumps something and it actually has a very sort of human reaction to that bumping.
Yeah.
Where it puts its hand down, it wasn't what it expected, and it sort of goes up. Wow.
So really now to this, I will also read you something I wrote now a few years ago. But it says, with its roots in the concept that smart technologies could be wedded to production systems, Industry 4 precepts were first introduced in 2011. It's a paradigm shift made possible by advances which constitute a reversal of conventional production process logic. Simply put, this means that industrial production machinery no longer simply processes a product, but that the product communicates with the machinery to tell it exactly what to do. I wrote that in 2017.
I'm still digesting.
And now it's being real.
This idea. So, I mean, because I heard about like Mercedes, or they're ordering these robots to work on the factory line.
Yeah.
At GMW. Which,
BMW. Okay. Thank you. But yeah, if, I mean, I having a human dexterous robot would be, you know, you could, that there's a cobot, which I usually think of as it's close enough to a human that you have a human do the motion, and then it's it that's trained it. But what you're describing here is, I need you to play, I need you to weld this seam, please. Right. And it would have enough understanding to know what the welds are, and it could say what tolerance or what, you know, which is a whole different concept from a manufacturing perspective for dealing with robots.
Right. And it's not just robots. It's robots, it's cobots, it's smarter equipment. Like, why is an industrial robot only programmed to do one job when you could remove the arm or the piece at the end of the arm and have it do a variety of jobs? And those are the ones that are coming out now. ABB just bought a software company. Siemens is going down that road. Caterpillar went down that road. Even Boston Dynamics, with its new orbit capability, which can map missions for Spot the Dog and other things. All of these pieces of technology are now being integrated in such a way that the multifunctional, closer to generalized AI, is not 5 years away anymore. It's maybe 2 years away at the longest.
I'm not sure that this is comforting.
No, well, I'm sorry. This stuff gets me very excited because
it's exciting.
It isn't just about factories. It's about things like firefighting, life safety issues, window cleaning, anything that puts a human at risk, but also can elevate us to take on more creative tasks. More brain work, not less. But this synthesis and synergy of these technologies is going to change the CIO role immensely, not just in manufacturing.
I agree with.
Retail.
Well, I think this is the IT worker in general, and you know, and to me this is the point of these conversations. It's, you know, we're already seeing it with LLMs and the way we're using GPTs. It's a question of understanding how to integrate your work products with these other components. And so the challenge becomes, how do we improve the work we're doing with the access to these technologies? And that's a creativity that it requires some out of the box thinking. This and letting go some assumptions.
Well, it's going to be a bloodbath of industry disruption is what it's going to be, because there's going to be so much resistance to change. It's going to disrupt the IT shop like the assembly line disrupted the manufacturing sector 100 years ago. It won't be the same, right? I mean, we're not taking IT people and putting them in the automation and in the process. They're going to be governing the process, right, and managing the process. So from an organizational job role design perspective, it'll be different. But in terms of the way that it's going to disrupt, it's going to be the same thing, because, you know, so many people are going to be stuck with the old way of doing things, and they won't be convinced until they see, you know, their company and other companies in the industry disrupting them.
I'm going to wear my skeptic hat here on this. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, there's potential for disruption. And it is possible that the technology is finally good enough to meet the promises. But we've gone through several cycles where technology has promised this kind of disruption and fizzled. I think the most recent one was no code, low code. before the where all the systems that promise to write your code for you, it's always fallen short. And again, like I don't want to be a Debbie Downer on this, but we've given our track record on these promises, I would rather be cautious. It doesn't mean that if the technology delivers, I wouldn't adopt it. It's more than I would rather take a wait and see approach and not put all of my eggs into this basket.
Well, I'm not sure that I don't disagree with either statement that technology has promised and not always delivered. I do disagree with the fact that there's already a rush to use generative AI. Right? Every CEO, every CIO, it's on everybody's top of mind list as number one. But it's without a purpose, a direction. Go find the business problem you're going to solve with this technology, or how is it going to make, you know, life better for your employees or benefit you on your suppliers, your customers, your bottom line or your top line. People are searching for those answers. This, on the other hand, says, here's how. Here's the example. This is where the combinations of technology really come into play. Imagine if that was not a younger, if that was not a young-ish person interacting with the cobot, but rather an elderly person who said, I need you to do X.
Yes.
That's something that, the idea, my point, Klaus, is simply that because ChatGPT is an HMI, and it's the first one that we can actually really get our heads around and really understand how it can benefit us, it's the reason that the robot is not scary. It's the reason that the advanced capabilities in cobot or cobot is not going to be as negatively disruptive as perhaps Tyler portends.
So there's an assumption here, and then there's something I want to explore after that here. So your contention is that part of the what's being demonstrated in the human interaction piece is a familiarity or an ease of integration that's been missing from that, and so that's part of the revolution here, is that by having human interaction models that are comfortable here. Mm-hmm. Right, then that makes the robots much more accessible to people. Exactly. Okay, and the point that I had after that was I wonder if there's a new role of programming that's fundamentally different than we think of programming today, right? Because programming, you know, programming is not in itself, you know, it's a language, it's not a distinctive thing. But I don't think, you know, all these AI pieces, you're not going to be programming a robot with code in the same way. But I think what we're describing here, the robot will need operational parameters and instructions that will be probably feel very code-like and likely limited to specialists who understand how to speak that parameterized language.
Yeah, initially, yeah, but it's going to change to a more natural language approach to defining, you know, your interaction with the machine very quickly.
I think
that's going to happen in like a year or 2 years tops.
My big concern with this is that natural language is terribly inaccurate. And we still have not solved the problem of turning natural language into accurate commands.
I fear that
ChatGPT is just going to, like, it's not going to solve this, but instead it's going to compound this. Like, and let's say 99% of the time, or let's say 95% of the time, because that's natural language parsing accuracy. 95% of the time, it will work great. The other 5% of the time, it will make things worse. And that is a big risk. Like, take for example, like, I mean, I'm going to take this to the ridiculous extreme, but let's say we built a HMI interface for piloting ships or airplanes.
No.
What if the computer misinterprets the routing requests?
That goes to a bigger question, which the word I use is lack of idempotency. Is it that with large language models, there's no repeatability? So we have to impose the same sort of controls and validation methods that we impose on human intelligence with artificial intelligence, because right now, I'll give you an example. I was doing some statistical analysis yesterday using ChatGPT version 4, and I was putting prompts into 3.5 and putting prompts into 4. And 3.5, it would look really realistic, right? But it'd be bullshit. Like it would show the math, and I'm like, okay, well, show your work. So it's got to show all the calculations in the step, and then I can figure out where it screwed it up. ChatGPT-4 was better, but I still would be in a situation where I would create a prompt and then, you know, refine that prompt through multiple iterations, and then take the refined prompt and enter it into GPT-4 5 or 4 multiple times, and I would get a different result. And sometimes those results were dramatically wrong. How is it different than like peer review and scientific articles, right? One of the methods we have for establishing information generated by humans is like the peer review process. Or if we're measuring the accuracy or validating the output of humans using like calculators, like, you know, we've created MATLAB to do, you know, statistical modeling and so forth and so on, where we've actually got expert systems that can validate what parts of what the human calculation is. I mean, even Einstein had his wife check his work, right? So I think our model and thinking about like RESTful systems and, APIs and idempotency really just does not fit this paradigm very well at all.
I agree it doesn't fit it. But I think what you're describing is an emerging capability. And this is actually where I think, and I'd have to air quote programmer, and it's because it's not prompt engineers either, is that the UX for these systems is, you know, to Joanne's point, is human speech. And not just human speech, it's actually body position, right? There's visual pieces. So interacting with that robot, it's you hold out your hand and it understands holding out your hand as a gesture, which is mind-blowing. But behind this, we have to have some type of, and this is really what programming is technical constraint definition.
Isn't that in fact what much of what Copilot does?
Yes.
In a primitive form. And it's why I just put an article in that was just dropped from IEEE about prompt engineering. What I think this actually gets to is the fact that you're going to have specialist agents You're going to have co-pilots. You're going to have interlocutors who are exactly what you've described, Rob. They're going to be the ones where temperature is turned way, way down, and they're going to have a serious amount of preparation, basically guardrails on some of the things and directives, but there will be a kind of a degrees of freedom that they have to work in within. And
Rich, if you would finish, to add on to that, this is where this is exactly what you just said is my thinking around why small language models and specialized, are the way forward. And this is also representative in that same video, because the neural networks that are behind both the robot and the OpenAI contribution to that relationship are well defined as small language models.
And this gets into the whole area of agentic architectures, multiple agents which in fact within the same kind of work group are actually supported by considerably different LLMs, different fine tunings, so forth. This is where I think this is going. Your issue about the smaller language models or the constrained language models, I think of them as SLIMs, small language models. These are, Star Wars had C-3PO, right?
Right.
That was the robot that was the interlocutor. Provided the social glue. This is kind of what we're talking about here. And what this article describes is work that's been done to compare human beings doing prompt engineering versus assisted prompt engineering done by an agent itself, and the value of the resulting value of the output, both in terms of call it item potency or consistency, determinism, but also kind of accuracy, all of the metrics. I think it speaks extremely well. And what that also says is, with the smaller language models, what are the architectures that support them? Does that actually have to be delivered as inference as a service as we are now seeing it? This kind of gets to the topic of the day, Ron, but
there's a topic of the day.
There's the topic of the day.
There is. And in this particular case, what I'm thinking about is architecturally placing small language models in edge architecture, in edge hardware. And by edge, I really do mean, mobile handhelds, something much closer to the point of both data generation and requests, where latency is a big issue.
Kind of feel stunned that the language model evolution is following the mobile hardware evolution, where you're having chips on the system for specific purposes, like voice decoding, like video.
Absolutely.
Specialization. Now, going back to the small language model thing, I would be remiss to talk about this and not mention expert systems.
Right. Which failed miserably.
Yeah. And to be fair, the exorcism failed because it was difficult to encode the knowledge. And it was difficult to map that knowledge to a human interactable system. If we can, it does feel like the goal of these small language models is the same as the expert systems.
In many cases, it is
a very constrained topic, and you want to prevent the language model from drifting away from that topic.
Absolutely.
So here's the situation. Just to class this point, and if we need to move, let's move. But to class this point, so here's a conversation that I had with a factory worker at an automotive plant on Monday. And it was recorded by Phantom so that I could be able to use it and throw it into GTP or anything else that's currently available to me here, because some of them are not released here, the models. I wanted to put it into Anthropic, but it wasn't here. We can't get access to it. I said, give me a scenario where you faced a problem recently and how you solved it. And the dialogue was about he happens to work in a print shop, but they're not just printing. It's basically 3D, a 3D printing house where they're making physical products from designs that people have created where they want to use it as a minimum viable product or something else. So I said, relate the situation, exactly what happened, exactly where, when you found the problem with the design, and exactly what you did to try and correct it. And he related the whole conversation. I then took that transcript and I fed it into an LLM and I said, break this out into a people, process, technology type scenario task. Record what would be the knowledge that needs to be acquired for an expert system or a small language model, and give me the result. And in about, I would say, 6 tries, I had the scenario laid down. This is the problem. This is when it was first noticed, how it was first noticed, and why it was first noticed. Visual was the issue because it was a 3D object that had been done by a 3D printer. And I also said, and what would have been other possible solutions, not just the one that this guy chose? And it gave me 6 different options. Change the filament, change the speed, check the hot plate, for where the temperature, for temperature deviations and specifications and so on. To me, that's the definition of the agent that you're talking about, or the interlocutor who had the context, who had a problem, had a solution, and then could take that one scenario and start building a library of scenarios to ask different people in different contexts to see what the answers would be. So
what was the intelligence that you used to lay out the strategy? With what system did you set out the initial kind of request?
The whole thing was recorded by Phantom AI, which did the summary, which did all of the, basics behind it. Then I took that and I put it into GPT. And I said, how would I do this with LangChain? And that was the tooling that I used. And I think that's where you were at.
That was what I was asking. Thanks.
Yeah. It was LangChain. And it, like I said, it took several tries, but eventually it got enough that I felt confident that I could actually, or one could actually use this, not the best method for sure. I'm sure there are much more sophisticated tools, but that you could actually put that together. Because my big issue And the problem that I've been trying to wrap my brain around has been on the knowledge acquisition side for the small, for the slim, and for how you would then take that slim and put it with human interlocutors to say, is this correct?
Mm-hmm.
So that you could pare down as much as possible the timeline that it would take to actually capture this and what companies could use to build their slim in a way that's not so intrusive to the person who holds the knowledge.
And I know what we've been doing and to try and capture this material is we've been, the beauty is it's very simple, right? You're having meetings and discussions where you're talking about the, you know, what's going on and what's happening. You're using the interactions that you've got to basically collect data. The difference between now and the old expert systems is that now we can use LLMs to, scan that information without it having to be in a expert system format.
Yeah.
And so we can basically vectorize that data and turn it into that knowledge. I guess I still believe that at the end of the, you know, we're going to get that, all that data, and then there's going to be some programmatic, and I'm using programmatic in sort of a general way, programmatic boundaries, conditions, how to use this information that's going to feed those models that's still going to need to be a framework around the knowledge base that we've built. And I think that there's still a room for a technical role. It's just different than programming would be, where you're understanding, like, oh, here's a model. It has these limitations, has these capabilities. Here's a person that, you know, is going to interact with it in some way, or it's a drone that's flying in space or a robot that's interacting. And there will be some type of language that has yet to be evolved, or, you know, I'm not as familiar in the pieces at the moment, that where somebody is going to have to be able to understand how to, you know, just like we translate between silicon and binary into human interface. There's going to be a, you know, human interface engineer, you know, a robot programmer or an AI programmer. It's going to be a weird.
I'm thinking of it as it's just going to be another layer of abstraction. You think about software programming starting with, you know, binary,
machine code
and actual real bugs beetles to, you know, then we had object oriented, right, where we created more modularity, and then, you know, and then much more recently we've got frameworks like Vue or React or Angular. Similarly, on the infrastructure side, we've seen a similar sort of abstraction, you know, kind of culminating in what RackIn is doing, right? You know,
yeah.
So thinking about, like, imagine Jade, like a test framework or React or whatever, and you say, hey, I'm going to build an app that does this, 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 and this. Why don't you deploy out this framework with all the associated libraries that I want? And then we start, right? So you've created this whole another layer of abstraction and getting things started and taking advantage of the hierarchical levels of modularity across the whole stack. That's kind of how I'm seeing it.
And it's iterative, done by a team. And like any other iterations with a team, you are going to go through cycles. You're going to look for improvements. The various participants are going to identify or address issues. And so, I think you're on to it.
Is there a need for a declarative component with this?
Yes.
Declarative? Yes.
Yes.
I'm going to be contrarian and say no.
Or maybe not necessarily declarative, but
deterministic.
I think Tyler was you who said, like, idempotent. yes. sort of reproducible.
What makes
declarative appealing in the IT world is that you write it down and then you use that to make things reproducible. You need to have the ability for doing reproducibility first, though, before you can do declarative.
Yeah, I think your point, Klaus, is the right one.
I didn't say the same thing. It's treat the AI like a human, right? You know, you're going to write some test and then you're going to dump it in a unit test and system test and go through the whole flow. And there is a mechanism for taking the output of intelligence and creating a declarative model, which is the actual code that I wrote, that then gets validated and verified through both human and non-human means. We've got our standard test regressions, but then we also have things like code reviews, right? So we're still going to have to do code reviews for intelligence. It's just in this case, it's not natural, it's artificial.
It's funny that you said like treat it as a human, because that's where I believe that exactly the problem is with LLMs. Like with a human, you start teaching them the basics and then build on top of that. With the LLMs, we're throwing all information in there and then telling it, okay, give me something for this. And if it's not right, like, all right, change it so it fits my view of it. So we're starting with a haystack and then trying to build a needle out of it.
Yeah. But
we're thinking of
LLMs as a monolithic model, right? You know, that we've got a neural network with 1.75 trillion parameters and we're going to input it. But that's not how human intelligence works. There are 17 different structures in the human brain. And 70% of that is the frontal cortex, the higher language, but you've got other specialized organs with the brain. So I was thinking about this yesterday playing with ChatGPT when I was using the text prompt to describe what I wanted, and it would call DALL-E and create images for me. And I'm thinking, well, this is kind of like the brain where the frontal cortex is doing, you know, the high level reasoning and then doing things like image recognition and things like motor coordination, where you've got lower level neural networks inside the human brain that are handling like motor coordination and other things. I also think about that when I'm playing my guitar and I'm, you know, grooving a finger picking pattern, right? It's like, well, that's, I need to get to the point where my frontal cortex is not thinking about the finger picking pattern. It's a cerebellum, right? And that's also what got me thinking. It's like, holy shit. GPT-4 has 1.74 trillion parameters. And the human brain has 100 trillion connections with 63 billion neurons or whatever it is. And, you know, if the frontal cortex is 70%, that means the other 16 brain structures are only 30%. So we're getting
those are the libraries.
Very shortly, LLMs will have the same number of parameters as connections in every structure of the human brain, except for the higher reasoning part. And that'll happen in the next 18 months. And we're going to, we haven't figured out the architecture of all of these different LLMs and how they're going to interact and all of that structure that will come. And I'm not smart enough to figure out what that's going to look like today, but we know that it's going to evolve in that way where you'll have, you know, just the language systems, the visual processing, the motor coordination, you know, all of the different components, right?
Mm-hmm. And by the way, the nature of those neurons, as you know, varies incredibly. I mean, you get into some of these neuronic structures that bear no resemblance to what you'll find in other parts of the brain. There is, you know, there's not just one kind of gate. There's not one kind of unit.
We're still doing matrix multiplication, though.
Well, this is interesting, and I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that we were talking about earlier, the SLIMS, the notion of a small language model, I've gone down the rabbit hole on this recent research that dropped out of Microsoft Research in China, doing ternary representation rather than floating point. And, you know, they're trying to, you know, quantize.
Yeah.
Huge step was what they're calling one-bit LLMs. And in point of fact, they're not one-bit, but yeah. they've played with them. And some right person came up with the notion, wait a minute, the advantage of one-bit LLMs is that I basically eliminate the need for multiplication. It's all matrix. All the matrix operations are addition.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Interesting.
So what this smart person did, or people did, were said, all right, if it's binary, if it's just zero and one, I'm not getting very good results. What if we did ternary? One, zero, and minus one. You still require only additions.
Mm-hmm.
The performance, well, the scale, the power laws for the what they're getting compared on the same LLMs to Llama 2, 3 billion, 7 billion parameter LLMs is about, all told, probably about an order of magnitude right now in both generating embeddings, delivering inference, memory footprint is significantly smaller, and the bonus, the frosting on the cake is this thing, these things apparently, and I haven't seen it in reality, run almost as well on CPU architectures as they do on GPUs, and you've basically eliminated all of them. Matrix multiplication, it's matrix addition, Tyler.
It's mind-boggling. I'd have to do some research. I mean, when you're talking, the first thing I was thinking is like, well, how does that work? So if we have a binary ALU versus a ternary ALU in the processor, and what the clock cycle cost for doing a multiplication or an addition, right? I'm thinking back to my assembly coding days and thinking, well, could it really be? Maybe, but it seems to me unlikely that taking a ternary mathematical operation that you then have to convert into a binary operation, so a standard ALU on a general purpose CPU would be able to process it.
You're go up a level. What they're basically saying is that the LLMs right now have, as long as they're using some floating point representation in the 4x4 matrices, as long as you're using floating point
calculations are expensive as fuck to begin with. So okay.
Exactly. So right. Once you eliminate
integer math, right? But it's not integer math, it's floating point. Never mind.
This is matrix addition as opposed to matrix multiplication.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
In preparation for quantum?
That's a good question, and I honestly don't know. I will, if you'd like, I will drop the paper or a reference to the papers.
If you wouldn't mind, I would appreciate that, because I was just working with something in quantum that sounds like there may be a future in that direction coming out of Big Blue.
Joanne, I think there absolutely will be. I think you're definitely onto something. I guess the way I would say it, though, is that it's not something that's in preparation for quantum, because that implies intentionality, but rather that things are evolving to a state that is going to be very complementary to what where quantum is headed. So I think there's definitely a convergence there.
Well, I think that, yeah, what I'm reading and what I'm hearing out of Blue and some of the projects in quantum is that our days of floating point are long gone. This is the way everything will go forward. And it makes perfect sense to me. I can't put my finger on exactly why, other than cost, calculation cost, you know, like any list of costs under the nomenclature cost that you want to give. But it's where I believe we're probably already there, but not in a commercial sense. In an experimental sense, absolutely.
Yeah, you're right. It comes down to like computations per watt of energy, and that has to take into account the economies of scale of production of the devices that you're gonna run the calculations on. Quantum may be many orders of magnitude more efficient. But until you have scale economies in terms of production of quantum systems, it's still going to be kind of the traditional silicon.
And again, what I think the impact of this is not on the foundational models that the giant LLMs. The impact here, in my mind, is on SLIMs.
Absolutely.
And what I don't know is whether there will be requirements for specialized hardware to run it on CPUs or do it well on GPUs. If I had any guesses to make, it would be the addition in silicon of a different kind of memory management. But that notwithstanding, it doesn't require 5 nanometer or 3 nanometers. It's
no.
CPU architectures that a lot of chip manufacturers know how to work with. Check out the paper.
I would not be surprised if eventually, once it's commercialized, we start with introduction of quantum coprocessors, like we did with floating coprocessors back in the year.
Absolutely right.
That would be very interesting. Agree with that. All right, we are out of time. So next week I am on the road, and I hope to be able to open this bridge up, but I don't think I'm going to have time. So I'm going to cancel us for next week. Sorry, y'all.
Cancel culture.
So what are you doing next week, Rob?
I'm visiting some customers in New York. I'm in Nashville for the first part at a bank automation summit, which is not as exciting to me as I thought it would be. And then,
I'm
in New York City.
I saw that on LinkedIn, and I thought about heading up to Nashville. It's only 4 hours for me.
Okay,
My ticket would have been $1,500. I'm like, really? Do I want to go for that beat down and pay $1,500 bucks?
Yeah. Well, you could have kind of, we have some discounts or complimentary tickets, but you should have.
Well, if you can hook me up, I may drive up for a day. But
I'll look. I think we're outside the window for it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
But we did and have some.
What are you doing in New York?
Visiting customers.
Ah.
So just originally there was an event, and that got moved out to June, and then it's back on. So, and
well,
my day's getting filled up, which is good. I like when I go to New York and my days get filled up. But Rich, I'm not coming out to see you anytime soon. Unfortunately, the Valley just hasn't had the siren call that I'm used to.
That's okay. I'll make my way. I'm actually making my way out to New York in June.
Okay.
Probably Chicago in May. I'm actually going to try to do a little bit more traveling.
Cool.
And I have reason to go down to the DC area, in which case I will make sure to let you know.
Yeah, come by.
On this one bit LLM stuff, let me suggest you read the paper. Mm-hmm. It's not very long, and it makes some pretty outrageously great claims. Now I'm waiting for independent verification on some of it. But let me know if you're interested, because I really have done a deep dive on some of this, and I'm starting to sound like a guy on the preacher on the street corner.
So I'm going to upload a file. It's actually a paper on written by some University of Chicago data science folks around their thoughts on how LLMs are going to disrupt data management.
I'd be really interested in seeing that.
Yeah, it's still, you know, they've got a long way to go in terms mm-hmm. of thinking about that. I'm partnering with a data science professor at SMU to write something around identity based data access. So that'll be coming out. I'll let you guys know when I get that written.
Wow. One of the things I love about the Cloud 2030 discussions is that even when we have an exciting topic planned, and that day we had planned to try and go back to our AI operations discussion, something near and dear to my heart, it's okay for us to have a exciting, interesting topic and apply ourselves to decomposing the impacts. This is what Cloud 2030 is always about, the impacts of that technology and how it's going to be programmed, controlled, used, and disruptive. Something that's a lot of fun to me when we talk about it like this. If you're listening to this point, and it's probably interesting for you too, I would encourage you to join us Thursday mornings at the 2030.cloud. You can see our schedule, our topics, bring in ideas, be part of our book club. There is so much fun to do and discuss in this group. I hope you'll choose to be part of it too. Thanks. Thank you for listening to the Cloud 2030 podcast. It is sponsored by RackN, where we are really working to build a community of people who are using and thinking about infrastructure differently, because that's what RackN does. We write software that helps put operators back in control of distributed infrastructure, really thinking about how things should be run and building software that makes that possible. If this is interesting to you, please try out the software. We would love to get your opinion and hear how you think this could transform infrastructure more broadly. Or just keep enjoying the podcast and coming to the discussions and, you know, laying out your thoughts and how you see the future unfolding. All part of building a better infrastructure operations community. Thank you.